Welcome to this podcast from the Core MD project. My name is Alan Fraser and I'm the scientific coordinator of this Horizon 2020 project, which is called Coordinating Research and Evidence for High-Risk Medical Devices. This is a large project which will run until 2024. And one of the reasons why it was set up was uncertainty about whether or not standards of evidence for high-risk medical devices used in clinical practice in Europe are sufficient. And therefore, there have been many people raising concerns that the evidence available to us as clinicians was insufficient. So today I'm here with Professor Per Skjærsgaard Andersen from Valle University in southern Denmark. He's one of the past presidents of the European Federation of National Societies of Orthopaedics and Traumatology, and he's a very experienced hip surgeon. And we're going to discuss how individual clinicians who use high-risk medical devices as implants in their patients every day in their practice can choose which devices to select and implant. So welcome, Per.
Thank you, Professor Fraser.
And perhaps we could go back to the start of your career and you could explain to us what your choice of devices was at the time. Let's say, how many hips could you choose from? And how did you choose at the start of your career what you were going to use when you were operating?
Yeah, now we're talking about the late 80s or early 90s, where I started my career. At that time, there was very few implants on the market for us who were doing the hip replacement. And the most frequently reason for using an implant was working together with the manufacturers. A clinic normally may have maybe one or two implants, and always it was from the same company. So there was a close connection with the company at that time related to what you're doing. There were no regulations, and there was very limited evidence for the implants. So it was frequently related to what you may use of implants related to what this institution was doing.
So you used what everyone else was using. But at that time, how many could there have been in existence throughout Europe? Are we talking about 5 or 10 or 20? Or how many models of hip replacement in the late 1980s?
I would say at that time there was maybe around 10, which was recognized and used very broadly. And then, of course, there was a lot of implants which were used on institution, frequently related to that the master or the chief in the department has decided.
So how has that changed over the years? If we think about current orthopedic practice, What is the choice that you and your colleagues now have?
Well, here you should know that we are talking about the Scandinavian country where I'm working, because I think it's a specific situation we are in. But the evidence we try to find today for implants is related to what we can find from registries and from studies. In my own country, we are running tenders every fifth year. And in the tender process, the specialists, the clinicians, are assisting the authorities in what implants could enter the tender process. And here we always are looking for what evidence there are. And the evidence we find is mainly related to the Scandinavian registries of total hip replacement. There are single-wise studies, but these are frequently single arms, and they potentially only report on safety with a single implant in a single unit.
So you said there were perhaps 10 hip implants. I mean, we don't know the exact number, but because there is no list publicly available in Europe, but Perhaps that sort of order of number many years ago. How many do you think there are on the market now?
For sure, there will be more than 100 on the market today.
So a huge increase in the availability. And within your own department, after the tender process, how many different models would you have to select from for the individual patient?
We have decided to have two on each technique we use. We use the cemented and the non-cemented. And there we have two different implants to make sure that we can overcome night over recalls or any other issues.
So two for each type, for each joint.
That's so you could say it like this.
You yes. end up with a limited number. And I think you've just said that you don't, in fact, use the scientific literature as much as you use registry data and the orthopedic recommendations from groups like ODEP and registry summated data. Is that correct?
That's true, because there are very limited publications showing the evidence of the implants. And if you find a publication, it's frequently related to a single institution.
And to what extent do you think internationally surgeons are influenced by advertising or by conference presentations or by recommendations from colleagues without necessarily looking into the detailed background evidence?
I think this part of comments you gave here are the main issue on the daily practice of selecting implants. As there are limited evidence, it is not where people are going to find the reason behind
it. So you're trying to overcome that in your own practice in Denmark, but can we be sure that happens everywhere around the world? I presume if there are more than 100 hips, then more than 100 different joints are used in different places internationally.
This is impossible to answer that question, of course, but you can speculate on that, of course.
And so do the patients ever ask you why you've chosen the particular model? And then what information do you give them?
Very rarely they ask what implant we select for them. We have a period in 2008 to 2010 where one of the resurfacing implants was promoted as a sports hip. It went into the media and patient came to us and requested to have that implant. And in my own institution, we didn't use that implant. So for that reason, patient frequently left us again and looking for other clinics.
But I think you're referring to a particular implant that then caused problems with metallosis.
That's true, but the patient didn't know about a single implant. They know about a sports hip.
But you're implying, though, that the advertising that reached patients may have, in fact, encouraged some centres to make a choice that wasn't based on sufficient evidence and that led to complications. So would it be fair to say that patients are relying on trust in their surgeons? And if that's the case, then what is the responsibility in a moral or an ethical way for the surgeon to know the evidence for the device that they're going to use?
For the first part of your question, yes, the patient frequently and nearby always trust that when we select an implant for them, we trust it related to safety and high quality. And that make the second part of your question very easy to answer, because yes, we as surgeons, we should lie on high responsibility for evidence of what we're doing, not only in the surgical procedure, but also what implants we select for our patients.
But that's true for all medical specialties, isn't it? Using high-risk implants, we ought to understand the evidence for each model or each implant that we're using for a patient.
Exactly.
And that's not always easy, because we know that the data are not always publicly available when devices come on the market. And indeed, I think that's what we've been showing with some of the systematic reviews within our consortium. So then I could go on to say that if the evidence is not always extensive, and considering that the outcomes of joint replacement are to last for 10 or 20 or 30 years, does the surgeon then have further responsibilities after the implant has been given to the patient?
For sure, because you have the reason for making a selection of an implant. And that reason is leaned on what evidence you may think is needed. And for that reason, of course, you are responsible on the long term for each patient, how it goes. On the other hand, we also know when we look at total hip replacement implants, it's not only the implant itself, it's more things which can make the implant being revised on a later stage. So I think it's complex to say that it's only related to the surgeon's responsibility.
The new European Union regulation on medical devices requires hospitals to be able to track patients who've had particular implants. So that's a responsibility for us all. And it means that surgeons would then be able to identify patients easily if they had a particular device for which problems were discovered. What do you think about surgeons contributing to collection of post-market data and contributing to registries?
It should be mandatory, because the example you just gave was an issue in many countries, including my own country, maybe 10 years ago when we had issues with an implant, we couldn't find the patients. So now a system has been set up where implant-related factors like the code, the barcode of each implant, is scanned into the patient record and into registries, and we can easily find them today.
So perhaps that brings us to the final comment, which is in our CoreMD project, we have the privilege, if you like, and also the responsibility of creating evidence and scientific advice for regulators in Europe. So how do you think the information that we collect in our clinical practice can be used for guiding future standards and future regulations and approval?
With a new medical device regulation coming up within the next years, I'm 100% sure that the regulators, and that including the notified body, will benefit a lot from the outcome of the CoreMD project and here be assisted in making a good choice for safety for our patients.
So we're working out collectively how to do this better. And I think you'll agree with me that this is something we would encourage all clinical colleagues to follow and try and implement in daily practice. So thank you for the discussion. And I encourage those of you who are listening to listen to the other podcasts in this series. Thank you.